Oh,
amen.
Thank you. Thank you. I said this last time, and it's true. This is really why I come back. Can you all hear me?
Yeah.
We have a new microphone. Well, when Tom talked to me about this book and which part of it I would like to do, partially it was the date which worked, but more importantly, it was the topic, because it was something I wanted to look into and I wanted to think about, and I did. But what I'm hoping to do today is find out what you're thinking about also, because I think this is an amazing chance for us to pay attention to something that we almost never get a chance to really talk about. And so I have things I want to say, of course, but I'm happy for you. If something really strikes you, put your hand up and...
And I'll come with a microphone.
Yeah, and or if you have a very loud voice, maybe, you know. But, of course, you'll have to keep it short, because I also want to talk first. And then in the second half, we'll gather up all the things that have occurred to you, and I want to hear what's happened. Well, when I read the book, I had some feelings about it, and I want to make some general comments about it, and I'm not sure I'm right about this. I'm not going to say that, but it was what struck me. I started trying to figure out, as may have happened to you, how does this apply to my life, to kind of check it out. Is this true for me? And I thought, well, maybe I've missed the turn, you know? Maybe I might still be in the first half of life and not aware that I'm actually moving into the second. But then, as I reflected on my life from the beginning, as much as I could remember or from what I had been told by my parents, I realized that I have, as I'm sure you have, experienced so many transformations, so many tragedies, so many turnings and comings, turning backs, so many conversions, let's say, over and over again. Mine began with my traumatic birth and the loss of my twin sister when we were born. That was a bad beginning, you know? So right off the bat, and it went on. So my comments about it, about this, came from that personal reflection. I wonder if it's too neat a package to think about our life in only two parts, mm-hmm. you know? I think it's helpful at times to think about it that way in the big picture, but it confused me a little bit to try that. It didn't quite work to see that there might just be one big, clear turning upward. Mm-hmm. I think it's more like a spiral. Mm-hmm. Lots of turnings. Mm-hmm. Maybe if we can see the bigger picture of our life, it does turn upward. But sometimes it looks like we're going down in the negative sense of that. One of my favorite bits in the book is in the preface, and I'll read it out loud to you. Whether we find our true self depends in large part on the moments of time we are each allotted, and the moments of freedom that we each receive and choose during that time. Life is indeed momentous, created by accumulated moments in which the deeper I is slowly revealed if we are ready to see it. So his reflections in this book about the true self, the deeper I, the part that we only find at times when our ego goes down a bit and we can get to it. It seems that way to me. And so these movements in the spiral are like that. These are momentous things, one moment at a time as we go along. How amazing is it? You know? So I also wondered if women experience falling upward in a different way, if that's possible. Do we do more, quote, second half work in the first half as we move along. I'll tell you that raising three teenage daughters through the 70s, you know, mothers and teenage daughters.
The way to sainthood.
Jude says the way to sainthood. Well, I don't know if that happened, but it was a turning, all right. So I think there are many ways in which we have a gender difference, and we may hear afterward from the men in the group who see that as well, that theirs might fit with Richard Rohr's system more clearly than mine happened to, and perhaps yours. But I like thinking about the fact that we have been spiraling and still are moving. So, but these are thoughts to discuss in the second half. I mean, of this morning. Well, I was so pleased to be introduced to Miguel de Unamuno. His quote, Richard starts with that in this chapter on the tragic sense of life, because that's the title of de Unamuno's book, probably his most famous book. So I spent some time after I learned about him, looking him up, and I was really amazed. I told my husband, I said, I think I've fallen in love with a Spanish philosopher. He is really quite amazing. He died, it turns out, he died on New Year's Eve, the year I was born. He had Roman Catholic, Spanish, philosopher, professor, who spent much of his life, more than once, being sent into exile away from the university because of his radical views about peace, about justice, anti-fascist views, all those things. So he really paid a big price. He lost a son early in his life, and that shaped the rest of his life. And he decided, as Richard Rohr points out, that the European world had distorted faith by aligning it with the Western philosophy of progress. And so for him, faith, which he had had to discover during the loss of his child, helped him to see that he could embrace the tragic sense of life and that that would be actually saving for him. So I think Richard Rohr's whole book is about that, about trust, about how can we trust, because when we're in a situation, as he's describing, where it's loss of a child, loss of a marriage, you know, loss of a job, just the bruising things that happen to our egos as we move along, without trust in God, we get stuck. There's no progress, you know, because we keep trying, right? Just keep trying. The same thing over and over, like Groundhog Day, you know. So I think that was an amazing thing to see how in this particular human life this was revealed. So I encourage you, if you're interested in philosophy at all, to take a look at him. There's a lot on Google Books. You can read enough to get an idea anyway. Well, certainly our culture in the United States is aligned with progress. How do we measure things? Gross domestic product. And the Dow Jones. Yeah, we're all very happy. Well, some of us anyway. When the Dow's going up, you know. And that's a sign that progress is happening, that things are coming back, that we're going forward. You know, all of those things are part of our culture. We're grateful for a lot of that because we like progress, but we have very little exposure to the tragic sense of life. Very little. We've been taught to overcome tragedy, disease, and death by progressing over it, you know, overcoming it. And we spend enormous amounts of energy and time and money to do that. I remember in the mid-70s when the hospice movement began, and I went to work for Hospice of Santa Barbara in the late 70s, in 79. It was the first hospice in Santa Barbara and only the second in the country. Mm-hmm. And before that, it actually had started in 74. But before that, you know, talking about death was not a matter of polite conversation. It was hidden. We hid a lot. And we tried our best to keep it hidden. So when we offered the first hospice class called The Hospice Approach to Living and Dying, we were stunned. We had hundreds of people show up. We'd set up chairs for a normal size, you know, lecture like that. It was overwhelming. And we realized people had been waiting to talk about this, been hoping to have a chance, you know. And I think some of you in this room were involved. I think Jenny was involved, Dawn was involved. Many others of you were involved in that movement in the 70s. And up even through now, you know, with volunteers, wonderful organization. But that was an amazing thing to see how hidden it had been and what a relief it was to be able to bring it out into the open, you know, and to have a chance to sit with people who were moving into that stage of their life and going beyond. It was amazing to me. I had not realized how much I feared that until I had a chance to experience being in the middle of it. And I'm sure that's happened to some of you already. And so we know that it hasn't been helpful to us to keep the tragic sense of life covered up. It seems to me that, I think it was a piece in Richard Rohr when he says that the shape and nature of reality is warped for us if we don't see the whole of it. So this is kind of an opening up, isn't it, to the whole of life, all the parts. I want to quote a couple of things from my lovely friend Unamuno. I am convinced, he says, that we should solve many things if we all went out into the streets and uncovered our griefs, which perhaps would prove to be but one sole common grief, and join together in beweeping them and crying aloud to the heavens and calling upon God. Now, the image of that was wonderful. I like to imagine it being in a great film, you know, where you could see this, people coming out of our houses and being in the street of the city and just wailing over the tragedy. And then he says in another piece, the chiefest sanctity of a temple is that it is a place to which men go to weep in common, a miserere sung in common by a multitude tormented by destiny has as much value as a philosophy. It is not enough to cure the plague. We must learn to weep for it. These are both from his book, The Tragic Sense of Life. At Trinity Episcopal Church, where I worship every Sunday, we have prayer ministers in the back of the church, and I've been a prayer minister over the years. It's an amazing experience to have people come with their griefs to pray, to be heard, to be given a blessing. And then I look on a normal Sunday when I'm not a prayer minister and I'm aware, you know, I think, how have they walked in here? You know, how have they been able to get here given what's going on in their lives? And it shifts, you know. It's not always the same people, but we're all in it together. And that's the sense we get when we pay attention to that. We're all in common with the tragic sense of life. I'm also a fan of Teilhard de Chardin, and you probably remember one of my favorite sayings or statements of his is about the time that he looked out over the city at night, and I've always imagined it being New York. I don't know, it might have been Paris, but wherever it was. He looked out over the city, and he began to think about all the passionate love that was going on in that city. The power of that. And this is what he said. Someday, after mastering the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness for God the energies of love, and then, for the second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire. Right. Well, I've always loved that since I read it the first time. But there's another one that he also wrote. Similar thing. Different time, different book. He's looking out again over a city. What a vast ocean of human suffering spreads over the earth at every moment. Of what is this mass formed? Of blackness, gaps, and rejections? No, let me repeat, of potential energy. In suffering, the ascending force of the world is concealed in a very intense form. The whole question is how to liberate it and give it a consciousness of its significance and potentiality. So, you know, I think for us to become conscious of the significance and potentiality of our own suffering, of our own places where we've had to come down and turn to go up, you know, would be really important. And I think that's why everyone I've talked to who's read this book has been excited about it, because it is something that we deeply intuit, that there's something here that if we paid attention to has the potential to energize us toward the more, I would say, the more of God, the more of our deepest self, the more awareness of who we really are, which we all like to cover up. And it's been for good reason, I have to say. We've had to do that a lot. There's another Teilhard quote from his book, The Activation of Energy. We are realizing that within the vast process of arrangement from which life emerges, every success is necessarily paid for by a large percentage of failure. I hear the yeses. Yes, exactly. One cannot progress in being without paying a mysterious tribute of tears, blood, and sin. It is hardly surprising, then, if all around us some shadows grow more dense at the same time as the light grows brighter. For when we see it from this angle, suffering in all its forms and all its degrees is, at least to some extent, no more than a natural consequence of the movement by which we were brought into being. The movement by which we were brought into being. So what Teilhard allows us to see and to imagine is that we actually are in the process that brought the world into being. We're still in it. It's still moving us. We're still experiencing the same process that got us here. Now, I think that's pretty exciting. I don't know about you.
All creation is growing.
Yes.
And that kind of thing.
Yes, yes. So it really does connect us to the cosmic view of life, to see that we're not alone in this at all. Anybody else have anything that's stirred in them up to this point that they would like to say?
I don't need it. I was struck by your saying that you were introduced to Unamuno. Well, I was introduced to him a couple of years ago by reading a wonderful book by Graham Greene.
Oh, yes.
Called Monsignor Quixote.
Yes, exactly, yes.
And it is a book full of a beautiful sense of the tragedy of existence and also the wonderful love between the communist mayor of a town in Spain and the local padre in the town.
Yes. Yes, Graham Greene was very heavily influenced by Unamuno. I found that out because I'm also a Graham Greene fan. So that, thank you for mentioning that. Well, in yes, Christine.
Do you think that the reaction after 9/11 was what you were talking about, us coming into the streets to to mourn?
Yes, we have some opportunities when things like that happen. And we know that we immediately lost it. It's a good example, isn't it? It's a terrible example of the inability to absorb the reality of the tragic sense of life. You know, and it isn't. And I, you know, I think both Unamuno and Teilhard, and I think Richard Rohr, see that this isn't just an individual situation, but it's a people's situation. So as a people, you know, we have that. Now, there are other peoples where we don't find it so strongly avoided, you know. And I think we all know we have experiences, or we've at least read or traveled to places where the tragic sense of life is part of life, you know. It isn't hidden. The dead are not hidden away. The ill are not hidden away. See, so it's a very Martha.
Rohr writes somewhere else about how less neurotic many of these like third world societies are. And I think this is one example.
Yes, I think that's right. How neurotic we are by comparison. Maureen, did you want to use your thing?
I was just thinking of the Irish Wakes, where the Irish don't really have the same attitude as we do at the death of someone.
Yes, yes. So we have a lot to absorb from this book as we go along, and I suspect I certainly will be thinking about it in the future often. It will help explain things that I might not have really wanted to think much about, you know. And it's hopeful because it gives us a sense that this is the way it's supposed to be, you know. That we are okay in it. We will make it.
When my husband died, my oldest daughter, who had been in third world countries, she said, "I want to hire professional whalers.
Yes.
We just can't cry loud enough."
Yes, 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 yes. I think that's, I have often wondered if we give people enough permission to come into our parish churches and just cry, just break down and cry. You know? So, you know, you might all take the risk and do it, just so that would open it up. It reminds me of the time when Nora Gallagher and I realized that maybe we should wear really sloppy clothes to church because people might feel better than the people who were out on the street might feel more like coming in. We haven't had the nerve to do it yet. Chris.
I'm recalling a time at La Casa de Maria where there was a retreat group that spent Saturday afternoon wailing at God.
Uh-huh.
I'm sitting in the office and I'm hearing wailing, filling the air. And we were all worried that it was going to disturb other retreatants. But at the same time, it was such an extraordinarily healthy feeling.
Yeah.
Why don't we do this more often?
Yeah.
So
these are all things to ponder. Now, one of the other quotes from Rohr's book that I thought fits here, would fit here, is when, you know, he's talking about the Odyssey, and he says, "Forces of good and evil play out their tragedies and their graces, leading to catastrophes, backtracking, mutations, transgressions, regroupings, enmities, failures, mistakes, and impossible dilemmas." Now, there have been times in my life where that was a very accurate description of what was going on. But each of these experiences, he says, is meant to lead us to a new knowledge and a movement forward in some sense. Yet, it is always a humbled knowledge. That's the difference. A humbled knowledge. More of the quote, "Failure and humiliation force you to look where you never would otherwise." In my own experience, which I call learning from the exceptions, he's using the word exceptions to speak about people on the margins. The exceptions. And there are many margins, aren't there? There are margins of health, margins of work, margins, all those margins. There was a time in my life when my, quote, normal life was falling apart. I had moved to Washington, D.C., and I was so falling apart. Remember the three teenage daughters. And a marriage that was also falling apart. And it made sense, you know. Also far from home. Santa Barbara had been home. And so I was forced to find a way towards some kind of meaning and also to get out of the house. And so I went into the city to see what the Sojourners community was doing on a Sunday, to see what their worship was like. Oh, that was really something. And so I asked the announcements. Jim Wallace said, "You know, we need a lot of help right now. And so if any of you have any time and would like to volunteer to help us, please come up afterward." Well, I went right up. And he laughed about it years later. He probably laughed about it at the time, but he was nice enough not to do anything. I said, "So what do you need help with?" Because my imagination was they need help to help with the houses. You know, they all live in common in these god-awful houses, and they probably need a little help to make them look better. Maybe I can arrange flowers. Maybe I can make food. You know, I was this suburban lady. So he said, "Well, we could use help on the magazine staff. Do you know how to type?" "Oh, yeah." "Well, how about, you know," so one thing led to another. And he said, "So how much time do you have?" I said, "Oh, all day, 8 hours." He said, "Really? Well, which day?" "Every day." I think he was so amused. He just said, "Well, okay, come tomorrow and we'll talk." So I go tomorrow in the worst neighborhood in the city. First weeks I was there, I drove our Mercedes into the and I parked it in front. Well, about the second week, the hood ornament was gone. About the third week, the hubcaps were gone. So my then husband said, "You have to take the bus, honey." So that's just the amusing part of the story. But what happened to me there is what's important, that I will never, ever get over, thank goodness. It was a humbling experience. At one time, they were working to do a shelter in the winter. This was about 6 months into my time there. And so we were all asked to volunteer on a given night in the shelter at Thomas Circle in Washington, D.C. So I go. I've had very little exposure to women on the street. Almost none. Oh, I'd seen them in town. I had given money. I was given a cot next to a woman who was really severely crazy, mm-hmm. severely mentally ill. And I realized I was afraid of her. Mm-hmm. But I thought, well, here I am. And my ego says, you can do it, you can do it, you know, you can do it. So that's why I ended up there. I could do it, you know, I could do it. I went to sleep. She went to sleep. Sometime in the middle of the night, she woke up in a frantic, and woke me up. And I thought, oh, here we are, you know. And I look at her, and I look in her to interact. We were very close. I looked into her eyes, and what did I see? I saw myself. Mm-hmm. I saw, suddenly, it was like a bolt. There's no difference between you at all. And there I was. Well, it took me a long time to get over that, I have to say. But not long after that, I kind of got primed, you know, so I started looking. I was walking from the bus to the office in the bad neighborhood, and here's a woman doing what we call dumpster diving. You know, she was getting things out. She would get something out. She would look at it. No, I don't want that. She would get something out. Oh, I'll take that. She'd put it in her basket. Mm-hmm. I saw myself. Mm-hmm. I saw myself shopping. I saw myself in the basement of the store, you know, where all the bargains are. No, I don't think so. I'll take that. And I knew again, there's really no difference. There's really no difference mm-hmm. underneath it all. Those were humbling, ego shifting turns for me. And there will be more, I'm sure. But those were ones that fit with what I read in Rohr's book. And then, partly because of my exposure at Sojourners, when I came back to Santa Barbara, I was working and leading a Bible study based on the basic Christian communities in Latin America. And we've been reading the gospel, you know, over the months. And we also had homeless people coming to the door, knocking, asking for food. And at that time, they were giving out two little cans of beans in a brown paper bag with some crackers and a spoon. But it was taking a lot of money because they were getting up to 75 people a day. And so pretty soon we got word that they were going to need to raise more money for this. And so I thought, my ego self thought, well, I can raise money. I can do that. So I start trying to raise money. Well, that was harder than I realized for this project. But then one day I suddenly realized we have got a cook who is our janitor living in the church. We have an old restaurant stove that's partly broken down, but all the burners work. And we had huge pots we could make soup. So again, you can do it, you know, got in there. And I thought we could do it. So we get Chinese takeout cartons. We start buying beans and rice and vegetables. And we run out of money. Mm-hmm. And so we had to raise money. So I'm in the park one day, and I had met the new rabbi, Gross Schaefer, Rabbi Gross Schaefer. And so he said, so what are you up to? I said, well, frankly, I'm trying to raise money for the soup kitchen. He said, well, how much do you need? Mm. I said, well, we're short right now about $700. He said, well, let me write you a check. I'm new in town, and my fund is not wiped out yet. So he gave me a check, and I thought, oh, we can do it. No, that was the end of that. You know, we didn't get another $700 check for a long time. So what we had to do was find a place to take things that people were throwing away. And so we found Vaughn's Market downtown, near us. Some of you probably helped us with that. We took garbage, essentially, and we sorted it, took out the good stuff, and made great soup. We had no idea what we were doing, so much so that we couldn't figure out how to make any rules. So we thought, we won't have any rules. We'll just make them up as we go. No, we're talking about Nora Gallagher and me at the time. Well, Nora Gallagher and I, a few years ago, went to volunteer at Christmas time at the new, beautiful community kitchen, and we looked on the wall, and there were the 20-some rules. And we said, wow. But the last one was what really got us. No having sex within so many feet of the building. We never would have thought of it. But the point is, you know, it's always fun to tell the funny part first, but the point of this telling you this is that something happened to us doing that work because we had to come down from our we know what we're doing and we can help and we can fix it. There was no fixing it. There was no way to do anything but take the garbage, make the soup, and feed the people who came. That's all we could do. But something happened to us, and we talk about it, the two of us, almost every time we're together to have a long lunch, this comes up, in relation to our life now. We reflect back on that as being such an amazing dip into reality. It was like we got dropped in to something that was so real that we had never, ever experienced anything like it. It was a lot of work. It was 5 days a week, every day at noon. But when we were there, and we did trade off, we got 16 different communities of faith to help us, so we weren't there every day, all day. But when we were there, we got this sense of, not only is this where we belong, this is where everybody belongs. You know, we're all, this is the most real thing. And so, part of it was that we had given up on trying to change it. There was no changing it. They're still doing it. You know? The community kitchen is still full. They're going to have to move it to other places because it's so full. So we see that the tragic sense of life, when we finally embraced it, changed us. So that may also...
What a great story.
It's an ongoing story, I think, for all of us to remember times when that happened to us. Whether it was sitting with someone who was dying, whether it was actually talking and being involved at all with someone who is really at the, what we would say, at the bottom. Who knows whether they're at the bottom or the top. The people who are the other, the exceptions, the people who are severely mentally ill, the things that frighten us the most. And then there are the other diminishments. They're the diminishments from inside ourselves, the things that aren't external to us. The aging, getting old. We age, and in our present culture, it takes a lot to get any meaning out of it, I think. I'm a fan also of Mae Sarton. I don't know if you're aware of who she is, a poet, novelist, and diarist she was. When I was 70, a friend gave me her journal called At 70. And a favorite passage of mine is about one morning when she looked in the mirror. I'm sure this has never happened to you, but she looked in the mirror and she was just struck by the age of her face. It was just awful. But then she reflected on that a bit and she wrote, as she's thinking about, she first asks herself, well, do I want to be 25 again? No. And then she writes, I am a far more complete and richer person than I was at 25 when ambition and personal conflicts were paramount and there was a surface of sophistication that was not true of the person inside. In some ways, I am younger because I can admit vulnerability and more innocent because I do not have to pretend. Isn't that lovely? I thought this was a great example of what Rose was talking about. And then she writes, what is it like to be 70? if someone else had lived so long and could remember things 60 years ago with great clarity, she would seem very old to me. I do not feel old at all. Not as much as a survivor, as a person still on her way. I suppose, I'm losing my place here, I'm sorry. Well, I think I lost that quote. But you get the gist of it, you know. She's saying that she supposes that real old age isn't like what she expected it to be, you know. That it would be more like what she's feeling now. So that's, I think, the most wonderful thing about being as old as I am in my mid-70s. To be able to reflect back and actually say truthfully, I don't want to be 25 again. I don't want to be 25. Or 30, or 40, or 50. So, you know, we can see as we look back. Now, if I looked at my life with its tragedies, I would not want to go back to any one of those. If I look at my life with its wonderful graces, yeah, I'd like to go back and experience my first child being born. That was amazing, you know. All those things, falling in love, that was great, you know. All those things. But sometimes I think we get mixed up, and when we think about our youth, that's what we think about. Don't forget the other part. Don't forget the other part. I think now we're almost at the time for the break, but I think what would be fun would be to look at this other part of the book about the stumbling stone for a few minutes. You know, and he had made it pretty clear what he meant by that the stumbling stone was really not being able to take these tragedies and see them as anything but tragic. So if we imagine that, and we can think about to this piece of trust that's so big in this book, that looking for where the trust of God is found in it, I think that's very difficult, hard to do. But we can sense it. I think it's almost an intuitive thing at first that we... our most recent tragedies in my family was when my husband became very ill with a staph infection last year and a half ago, and then had a stroke and then almost died, and you know, we went through this horrible summer. But, you know, at the time, there was something underneath it that I could barely, I can't tell you that I could really get it at the time, but I kind of knew it was there. And I thought, I think when it's over, I'll see it. I got a sense that I was not falling off a cliff. We were not drowning. There was something holding us. And I'm sure you could describe it in many different ways. But there's that sense that in the middle of all this, I can still see something, a light somewhere here. So that's the stumbling block. Without that, a lot of things would not have happened. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the book that we became familiar with because of this illness and the stroke. The book called My Stroke of Insight. Are you aware of that book? This is a book written by a young woman neurologist, neuroscientist, who had a major stroke. And because she knew what was happening to her, she saw that she was going, and then she was able to get help, and then she started the 7-year battle to come back. But in the midst of the battle, maybe very early on, she writes about this sense she had that is also talked about by the mystics, and by people who've done amazing life of meditation, who get some sense of unity, you know, a deep sense that we're connected to everything. She had that experience full blown. She didn't really want to come back. She knew that she had to, but she didn't want to come back in the same way. Now, I'm just probably way over generalizing her book, but you can take a look. She started saying things like to herself, like, there's a part of me that I used to have that I don't want anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't want my competitive nature. I don't want that ego that got me where I was. Very young, 30-some-year-old woman in charge of a huge department of neuroscience. You know, I don't want that anymore. I want to come back, but I want to come back not losing this piece I've learned. If you want to get a sense of her, she, and I, my brain... I cannot remember her name. I think her last name is
Jill.
Taylor.
Jill Bolte Taylor.
Taylor. Jill Bolte Taylor. Thank you. She did a TED Talk. And if you know how to go on YouTube, you can listen to her TED Talk. It's wonderful.
Oh, yeah. She's something.
And she says exactly what Rohr is saying, but she had a physical human experience of it and analyzed it as she came out of it. And my stroke of insight is what she called her stroke, a stroke of insight. My husband had something not as bad, but a similar outcome, where suddenly, you know, he was really most, he had had to be working out of his left brain all of his life. Academic, had written 21 books, you know, my heavens. Had this stroke. When we used to go to an art museum, David would take a book, he would go into the restaurant and read. This is just one example of what happened. 6 months later, he was well enough to go to LA to see a friend, and the next day we went to the art museum. David was dragging me around, saying, "You don't want to miss this, look at this. I am grateful." You know, it's an amazing thing that there are things that we do not understand about our brains. But, you know, the sense of wonder about these shifts is what I'm excited about. So you might want to take a look at the TED Talk of Jill Nolte Taylor. And I think we should take a break.
Well, thank you so much. I think we're privileged to have Andrew.